packet pushers.
Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, you amazing human you. Today, we have a very special episode. It's a crossover episode with the hosts of Heavy Strategy, also on the Packet Pushers Network. We've got Jonah Till Johnson and Greg Farrow here with us, and they're going to be talking about enterprise AI. What stuck out to you there, Kyler?
It was the friendliest fistfight I have ever been a part of. It was fantastic. And technically, I thought it was interesting talking about little AI versus big AI and how we're starting to see industries all over start to move from little AI, which we use broadly, to big AI. So listen for that on this podcast.
Don't be surprised if they get a little argumentative, because that's their whole thing. And so enjoy this episode with Greg and Jonna. Well, Greg Farrow, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. We've been on your network for quite some time, and we haven't ever actually had you on the show. So why don't you tell the good folks who might not know you who you are and what you do?
I'm Greg Farrow. I've been a networking influencer, even back before there was influencers, back in the days when they just called us bloggers. Do you remember those days?
Vaguely, yeah.
Anyway, obviously, I've been over on the Packet Pushers Network in doing the Heavy Networking Podcast, the Heavy Strategy Podcast, and the Network Break. So mainly my focus has been networking for most of my life. But what we wanted to do is a bit of a crossover here today. So I brought Jonah with me. So why doesn't Jonah throw in her tuppence worth to tell the people who she is?
I will. But first, Greg, I have to ask, don't influencers recommend things like lip gloss? So I want to know what kind of lip gloss I should get. Any recommendations?
Usually a stout or a fine bitter.
That'll work. Except I don't want that on my lips. I want it all the way down. So
over the lip, over the gums, look out, Tommy, here it comes.
Exactly. So I'm Greg's partner on Heavy Strategy, the podcast that talks about where the questions are more important than the answers, or more accurately, there are no right answers, but there are some right questions. I also run Nemerdes, which is a 20-year-old firm that gives advice, sometimes solicited, sometimes not, about technology and technology strategies.
Awesome. And one of the things that you recently had some videos on and done some research on is enterprise AI. So that's the hot topic of the day. Everyone out there seems to want to slap a coat of AI paint on their offerings or talk about how much they're using it. I'm curious, from your perspective, Jonna, what does it mean for an organization to do AI?
Wow, that's a really long answer there, Ned, I could give you. But I think the important thing to understand is that AI, in many respects, is a feature, not a product. We are all currently conditioned to think of AI as a product because of ChatGPT. And certainly LLMs are products and they do change how you do data analytics. But functionally, AI is built into almost every product that you would buy. So for example, products for managing your data center typically have various flavors of AI built in so that you can do observability and predictive analytics. And then maybe they're just adding an LLM so you have a friendlier user interface. But you got to understand that under the broad umbrella of AI, there are a lot of different technologies, and many of them have been built into management security products and tools for umpteen years at this point. That said, when we did a research study on enterprise AI, we were primarily but not exclusively looking at LLMs and generative AI when we asked those questions. And you know, one of the big things that we found as a takeaway is that organizations are now starting to think in terms of organizing around AI, and both within IT departments as well as outside of IT departments. So where you see some of the benefits kicking in are within IT, operational efficiency, and outside of IT, more things like better interactions with clients, richer relationships with clients, and better data analytics.
I agree with Jonah. AI is not a product in its own right, except if you're using it to replace search. So once upon a time, you would go to Google and say, you know, what is CXL? And then you would find a website that would tell you what a CXL is, and you would start to read it. Now you can go into an AI, an LLM, and say, what is a CXL? And it'll give you a summary. That is a better version of search. And in fact, Google's revenue is already down 10% because of this. I don't know if you've noticed this. So Google search revenue is actually falling away at a rapid rate. That is the impact of AI already in that sort of sense. But my point is that we are seeing AI as an add-on to everything else. So Microsoft Copilot being added into Microsoft Office, it does something, helps you write gooderer or write, you know, writes letters. You say, like, tell it to write a resume and it'll write a resume for you. Won't be very good, but it'll be better than, you know, spending 2 hours writing a first pass sort of thing.
I've talked to several engineers that have it sort of soften their language a little bit. So they're very direct. And then it's like, can you make this kinder? Can you make it a little more flowery, please? And I've gotten good feedback from that use case.
Yeah, I always had a lot of fun telling it to write it in a sci-fi mode, like and tell it to go really epic science fiction and go see what your resume looks like when you do that.
Oh, and Greg, you've actually done that to promo some of our podcasts and the results are hysterical. Oh, they're funny.
Always take time to play with it. It's kind of fun. You can learn a lot about prompt engineering when you do that. But the other side of this is what we're also seeing is tools like Salesforce and, you know, all of those line of business tools that we have that are so structural, they're adding AI. And particularly SaaS tools, which contain all of your data, are now being able to strap AI into parts of that and say, oh, I can see that this is an invoice that needs to be paid. Do you want me to automatically post this to the general ledger, right? If you're doing accounting, or this is a lead, I can see a matching purchase order. I should mark this lead as automatically closed and update the details. Do you want me to do that for you automatically? So what we're seeing is AI is an accessory. You don't go out to your favorite reseller and tell me, please, sir, let's talk about which AI I'm going to buy, because that is not how you're going to consume it. But weirdly, that is how the infrastructure looks.
So Greg, as a network influencer, you're basically saying you're now promoting accessories.
I wouldn't say I'm promoting AI.
That's true.
I mean, we'll get into this further on down. I don't think AI is as disruptive as people think it's going to be, right?
Except to Google. And in fairness, I'm actually really happy you highlighted that, because about a year ago, I said to a reporter that AI was an existential threat to Google, and they just blanked on me. They were like, why would that be? And it's like, because if Microsoft can answer your questions better via AI than Google can via search, why would anyone go to Google? They wouldn't have any more eyeballs to sell.
It doesn't help that Google has actively been making their search interface worse over the last 5 to 10 years.
You know, you do a search now and you get a page and a half of ads that aren't relevant to what you're searching for, if indeed it can even decode what you're trying to say. So there is that. And so it's actually driving people. When you are trapped in the Google system, that was a thing. But now that entrapment that they've been using to drive over excessive revenue extraction is now driving customers somewhere else. It gives you an incentive to go into an AI tool.
And Greg, when you said trapped in Google, I'm sort of twitching here, because all these years I thought I was so smart because I was one of the 10% of people using Bing instead. Contrast was much cleaner and nicer. But now that it's got all this AI crap larded over it, I'm like, oh man, I'm going to have to go to something else.
I actually use DuckDuckGo and have done for years. And I will switch to Google sometimes, but most of the time I actually use a special tool called Devon Agent. And that is a tool that straps a search engine into an app on a Mac. And it then goes out and queries the engines for you that you tell it that it wants to talk to, and then presents you an interface to be able to go through 500 results very quickly. There are ways to get around the search engines that most people don't know about.
I want to bring us back to something both of you said earlier, which is that we have this broad fear that AI is going to replace all of our jobs, including podcast hosts, potentially. I'm very worried. But both of you said we're already in that future. That's already happened. We are swimming in AI among many systems that we already use. So that's not the future we're scared of. It's the present, and it's not been as disruptive as we worried that it would be.
I wouldn't get that far. I'd say we're definitely in the emergent phase of AI, right? And if you're somebody like us who stares into the abyss and then suddenly the abyss starts staring back at you, you can feel like everything is around you. But then you go and talk to somebody out in the real world and you realize they don't even know what an AI is. They couldn't spell it. If you know, they go A-Y, you know, something like that, right? So just a reminder that just because we know what it is doesn't necessarily, and the world that we're surrounded in. So it's an emergent phenomenon if you want to go down that part of the trend. And we can see clearly that it is going to have an impact, but it's not going to be as disruptive as people want to make out. And we'll talk more about that in a minute.
Yeah. And I mean, just to put some quantitative terms around this, when we did a research study, we interviewed enterprise AI folks, or folks that were in tune with their enterprise AI strategies, and only 18% said they expected there would be a reduction in overall headcount due to AI. More saliently and more tellingly, what we saw when we asked separate questions, how big is your AI team within IT today? And how big is your AI team outside, or are your teams outside of IT? Whatever the numbers were, it didn't really matter, because that depends on how big the company is, et cetera, what its vertical is. The growth rates for these teams were both on the order of 100% year over year for the next couple of years. And essentially what we're saying is that AI wrangling will create more jobs than AI will reduce. So it's not that there are jobs that are going away.
there are jobs that are going away, but AI wrangling will come in. And actually, you know, you mentioned prompt engineering, Greg, a little earlier on. A lot of the new jobs that are arising are things like prompt engineer, or my favorite, ethnographic researcher. And these are people whose job it is to actually understand who the customers are and think about how different perspectives may affect how they interact with LLMs so that the LLMs don't react poorly for groups that they haven't thought of. And what's fascinating about both prompt engineers and ethnographic researchers are these people typically are people that have undergraduate degrees in the humanities, and particularly, I was told, literature. Literature is good because it helps you look at multiple points of view. Good literature actually has lots of characters with different perspective, and you are actually trained to analyze when you're doing literary criticism. You're trained to analyze how a character's insight is tied to that character's point of view. Also, the use of symbolism is actually incredibly important. So one of the fun things that AI may do that people aren't expecting is create a whole bunch of job opportunities for people who aren't in STEM.
I think that's a really valid point. I mean, for me, it's about we're going to see the impact at an operational level. So there's an operational reality here that AI can really enhance the operation. So I want to go back to where we were, say, 10 or 15 years ago. You'd ring up your bank and they'd have to ask you your name. Are you who you say you are? Authenticate you. And then you'd have to read out your card number and so on and so on and so on. But now we have apps on smartphones, and the number of calls that goes into a bank is dramatically less because you can check your balance. Does anybody here remember when you could ring up a telephone banking to get the balance on your bank account?
I do. Yes.
Right?
I had a text line that I would text and it would text me back my current account amount. Yep.
So that's automation, and AI is just another version of that. As far as I'm concerned, that's all we're looking at here. AI says, you know, today we replace that with a smartphone app. Tomorrow, AI will be able to, you know, tell you what your balance is before you even know you wanted it. It's just an acceleration of an existing technology trend in terms of what the user sees. And the same thing happens in office work, where we start to see AI used for, like, there's a whole AI startup. I got a press release today, a whole AI startup, and their job is to take text and put it in a spreadsheet. That's it, right?
That's actually one of the points that I try to make, that if your job is primarily cutting and pasting, you should be very afraid of AI. But then again, you should probably be wanting to poke needles into your eyes if that's actually your job. So go find a job that isn't cutting and pasting. But I do want to come back to this, because a fun little exercise that you can try is replace every occurrence of AI with data analytics, and you will be spot on for 99.9% of the time. And what I mean by that is the companies that have their arms best around AI, according to our maturity model, typically are companies that have mature and in fully featured data analytics teams. And they've been thinking about the potential for combining data in new ways for freaking ever. And AI is just a new way to combine data in different ways. It's actually a set of algorithms for combining data in different ways. Now, that said, it's not enough to have a good, sophisticated data analytics department. You're going to have to make some changes in order to cope with the new algorithms that are coming along with AI. But basically, if you start from the standpoint that having enormous amounts of data is the wave of the future, and being able to make sense quickly of enormous amounts of data by whatever definition of make sense quickly and enormous amounts of data, if you understand that, you've understood most of the implications that are coming downstream with AI.
So for me, analytics is really interesting because we have so many companies out there who say they're data driven. We've all heard we're data driven. We're a company that's data driven. And inherently, when somebody says, I'm data-driven, it says, I'm only looking backwards. Because the data that you're looking at only tells you what happens yesterday.
That's not true at all. Predictive analytics is a key piece of data analytics, and it's something that people do quite a lot of. I understand your point, which is data analytics is only useful if, you know, it's great that you've got trackers on the wheels of my car and you can tell wherever I've gone in past. What you is for somebody to say, Jonna is planning to drive to Baltimore next week. Now, that would be useful. And if you're able to do that with a high degree of confidence, then now you're cooking with gas.
And that's where AI steps in, right? So in data analytics, the predictive part of data analytics is very weak today. They can do linear extrapolations, but they can't bring in unforeseen data points. They can only do linear extrapolations based on this is what we did yesterday, and I can't predict into the future. So if you come back into the data analytics and say, like, if this happened, what would happen to the sales, you know, like, or what would happen to costs or something like that? There's a very weak correlation in data analytics being able to accurately predict the future. Whereas AI is going to be able to say, if I'm working in a particular industry, I can get an LLM that's trained around, or an LAM, or, you know, one of the many different types of models that's being generated, you know, inferencing today, and say, for this industry, we have a much wider pool of data upon which to draw upon. What is the extrapolation for the future here? And it can give you a much more effective. So I think data analytics is going to go through a massive transformation in that sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges that I see is the fact that AI and data analytics before it had no context in which to place what they understood. So, you know, if you're thinking about planning a trip, you understand the broader context. And so if you hired like a personal assistant, they would also understand that from a human perspective, but AI only knows a small subset of that. So giving it additional perspective and context is going to be helpful. And you've seen that as LLMs sort of start broadening how much context they can keep in their mind at once, as it were. That has improved their response because you can refine something that it's already given you. Or you can text a bunch of responses together to get something that's more useful at the end. That's a technique that's been used. Jonna, I want to get back to the real world a little bit because we can navel gaze a lot about AI, but you like went out and actually talked to other people who are on the ground doing this stuff. What were some key takeaways that they had around how they're implementing AI for real in the enterprise today?
I think the first thing to keep in mind is, as I mentioned, but I'm going to hit on it again, that folks are developing teams to manage AI, and they are cross-functional, cross-disciplinary teams. And I want to stress that because people kind of make the mistake that they think of AI as, well, it's an algorithm, it's computer science, and therefore it's only really the techies we need. We need the big data folks. And that's not really the case. Having teams is kind of a big one. So the top use case that we found for enterprise AI was internal operations, improving internal operations. And Greg gave some great examples of how you can much more effectively improve internal operations, even for something as simple as the data center, having predictive analytics so you can know what's going to happen. One of the very interesting conversations I had actually just last week was with an IT guy at a private equity firm, and I started talking about the possibility of using AI to predict a futures in cloud computing. And what I mean by that is, if you look at what airlines do, they're constantly buying, they're locking in prices for jet fuel because they figure they know better than the fuel producers what their needs are going to be 3, 4, 5 years out. And the same thing is happening with cloud computing as people are realizing how incredibly expensive it is. One of Greg's favorite comments and topics. The idea that you can be using AI to figure out, okay, I want to lock in this many CPU cycles from this cloud provider at this price, you know, 2.5 years from now, well, more realistically, 2.5 months from now, that could actually be a way to reduce your costs. And that's an example of using predictive analytics via AI in a very nuts and bolts fashion. The second most common was customer focused. And that's not the typical, you know, it's not what everybody's afraid of, that you're going to put in a chatbot or interact with a fake human. I think we've seen enough to realize that people get frustrated with that. And what they actually want is to deal with a live human that has all the context available and has some recommendations. So, for example, when you talk to the financial services firms, the people that are, you know, wealth advisors, right? They're the ones where you call up and you say, hey, I'm getting nervous about the market. What do you suggest I do with your portfolio? What AI will let them do is not replace the person on the other end of that phone, because I want to talk to a human. Damn it. I'm, you know, spending a lot of money for you. I want to talk to a human. But that human may say, you know, we've done this deep analysis and here are my recommendations. And truthfully, that human may not have looked at all. All of that analysis could have come up from the AI. And all the human has to do is ask, does this even make sense? Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, wait, this is a hallucination. We're not going to recommend this to the client. But that enables them to be a lot more creative with what they recommend and to have all the context that, Greg, you were talking about before, without necessarily having to do very much work.
Yeah, this is one of the things. In fact, somebody in our the Packet Pusher Slack channel the other day said he took all of the documentation from the vendors and then exported all of the jobs out of his help desk system related to a particular technology, ran it into an LLM and generated his own model. And he's now got an AI assistant that can actually tell him how to fix network problems. right? Wow. It's actually generating configuration changes. You know, he says this is what the fault is and this is what it's doing. So this is an example of small scale AI. Not everything has to be this epic, you know, trillion-dollar investment, massive mega cloud. This was all just done on a PC, right? Here's the thing for you, just as I mentioned, we'll talk more about silicon probably in a little bit, but the point is, do you know that Apple's been shipping AI silicon inside of iPhones for 3 years? Everybody's going Burko over NVIDIA's GPUs and blah, 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 but Apple's actually been shipping AI silicon, its inference engine, for 3 years since the iPhone 14. Actually, I think even the iPhone 13 was the first generation. And that is how they do a lot of Siri and so forth. That's Apple being very cyclical. They evolve things over time. But the point is that AI is already here. So if you wanted to do AI like that, down on the ground, small scale, how do you get your first level help desk to be so smart that they can actually solve problems without escalating to level three is one way to look at it. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense, and it is what people are doing. And I think that this highlights something that I definitely want to get out there, which is that AI really is much more about marketing than anything else. And what I mean by that is, if you just called it a bunch of algorithms that enabled you to analyze data more effectively, it wouldn't have gotten anything like an executive order for how to manage a bunch of algorithms that help you analyze data better, or an open letter to the industry for a bunch of algorithms that help you manage data better. What people are doing is going bonkers about this I and the AI, and they leap from intelligence, and I'm air quoting that, to sentience. And all of a sudden they're in the world where, you know, the robots are ruling and we're in Isaac Asimov and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, guys, no. No, really. It's just a bunch of clever algorithms that together can have some very effective outputs or crazy outputs.
If you ever look how they generate images, it's autocomplete. They basically say, if I'm generating an image with this, the next pixel is going to be this color. That's literally how they do the image generation. It's just autocomplete on a scale that the human mind can't comprehend. I wanted to come back to something. We've been proposing that AI is going to be a very powerful and positive tool, but there's also the dystopic vision here, the one where AI is watching you walk around the office. How many cups of coffee did you have? How many times did you go to the toilet? How many keystrokes did you make? How many emails did you send? What was in those emails? How many documents did you save? How many words did you write in a day?
That's actually not AI. That's the data collection engine, which, you know, could have AI behind it or could not. Obviously, it's going to be a lot more valuable if it does. But let's stop there, because there's the question of what data can you capture?
Your employer can start to rank you based on, like, how many times did you go to the toilet? Well,
yeah, but that's not an AI thing. Let's just be clear. That's a data collection thing. And that's been around forever.
But the AI can normalize that, process that at scale, and then be able to present a report up and say, this person's not a good worker because they didn't save documents. You know, there's all these, you know, metrics summarized up, right?
And make it so much cheaper and more accessible to more businesses. And that's kind of scary, that kind of dystopic monitoring can become cheaper.
It doesn't, though. You know, you got to take a system engineering approach to this. How are you actually instrumenting everything and instrumenting all those cameras and wiring everything? AI doesn't make that any cheaper, right?
No.
The analysis, yes, it makes possible something that wasn't easily doable before. Yeah. But the cost is going to be in the instrumentation to figure it out.
Okay, so we'll step it up again. Look at what vendors are doing with their subscription licensing. Every license that you have, you are now in a situation where, let's say you have a storage array or a networking device, all the data about your use of those systems, those subsystems and servers, is now all going up to vendors. They can see that you've got X number of servers from vendor A and X number of servers from vendor B, and they can see your utilization and they can see the use cases, and they can go like, oh, hang on, this customer is running out of capacity. We need a sales rep to be out there knocking on their door, telling them to buy more, right? So there is another, that what we're now seeing is this sort of AI as sales generated from data taken from inside the customer systems themselves. In some cases, that can be very great. Like, you don't want the salespeople harassing you all the time saying, when are you going to buy something else? We need to get you a price. You really only want to see them when you've got the next phase of a project coming online, right? You want to be whatever. On the other hand, what we're actually seeing right now is that vendors know more about a customer's infrastructure than the customers know themselves. And the dynamic between them is actually no longer equal. The customer's no longer in control because the vendor's now got more information about what's happening than the customer does.
What's interesting is a lot of the best salespeople that I ever worked with, and we talked about being in sales a little bit before we hit the record button. Some of the best salespeople that I knew took that same approach just without AI. They were very aware of what their customers were doing. They were looking at their consumption levels. They were talking to the project managers and the higher ups to know what's coming down the pike in 2 years and 3 years. This is just doing that at scale through some new tool set. And that seems to be like the recurring theme of AI is we already do all of this, but now here's a way to do it at scale and a way for previously unskilled folks to do the same thing, because I don't have to be that amazing sales guy anymore because now I have the amazing sales AI.
Vendors are very keen to reduce sales. Like, take for example, Cisco spends over 50% of its gross income is spent on sales and marketing, which is extraordinary when you think about it. The actual products that you buy, and this applies to all of them, Dell, HP, the numbers vary a little bit, but roughly 50% of anything that you buy from a branded vendor is sales and marketing. The cost of selling it to you, the cost of marketing it, you know, all that sort of stuff. That is not the cost of support. That is not the cost of production. That is not the cost of shipping. So if you're spending $1 million on IT, $500,000 of that was the cost of selling it to you. Mm-hmm. If we could reduce that, the vendor would make more money. Obviously, the customer has to be smart and try and get some of that for themselves. That's not going to happen. Customers are always stupid. They always lose. But the point is that that money is there for somebody to get a hold of, right? If you could reduce the cost of sales and marketing, would we be better off? And the answer is, in the long run, potentially so.
And I think sales is a great example, as we were talking about, because sales is something that inevitably has a human component to it, but also is like engineering. It's pass fail. Either you made your number or you didn't, either the bridge fell down or it didn't, kind of thing. Very highly quantitative. And I think it makes sense to look at how you're using AI within sales and sales operations, because that's going to change what the behavior patterns you need of your salespeople. You don't need the person to be necessarily that intuitive what-if-ing, but you do need the person to be incredibly congenial and capture the data that can then be fed into the AI that can then generate the recommended next actions. And oh, by the way, if you're the back-end sales ops person, you'll need to understand what data ought to be captured. You know, and it might be as simple as, are your prospects usually busy on Thursday mornings? What are they usually doing? Is there some way we can take whatever that workload is away with our tools and, you know, products?
One of the interesting outcomes here is that sales might actually become the most dumbed down position, because they will have all of the data and potentially in a quite a good analytics system to be able to extrapolate what needs to be sold here.
I don't think it'll be dumbed down. I think it'll just put a lot more emphasis on
inside sales instead of outside sales.
Inside sales instead of outside sales. And the few people that make it as outside sales are going to have to be rock star friendly and charming.
Creeps. Yeah, the creepy ones. Yeah.
Well, no, because actually what I've found in general is good, trustworthy salespeople are not creeps. You have to actually act with your...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I was being a bit snarky.
I know, because you always hate vendors.
I always just call them creepy, because that's how they come across. They come across as false.
But if they come across as false, then they're not good salespeople.
Or maybe I've just got a different personality to most people.
No, I think you've just been dealing with different salespeople.
It sounds like it's right in our thread that we've been pulling on, that this will not be transformative for sales. This will be an assistant tool. This will be an add-on to sales. Relationships and congeniality is still core to sales, as it has been forever.
It'll go back more like a doctor-patient relationship or a... You know.
Bingo. Exactly. So, in fact, think about doctors and patients. That's another great example. Today, everybody complains, at least in the US, because you walk in and you get 15 minutes and your doctor won't talk to you and see what's going on in your life. It would be nice if the doctor looked up and said, oh, hey, Jonna, how did the move go? And I understand blah, 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 blah. And they're already completely up to speed on what's going on in your life. Now, in fairness, my doctor does that, but I'm outside the system for her. So, which is one way to do it.
One of the interesting things here is, though, is everything that we're talking about here, there's still a human in the loop.
Yes.
Yes.
If you look around at all of the great stories about AI being an apocalyptic disaster for companies, like I'm thinking of the one which was a chatbot for the Canadian airline where somebody got it.
Oh my God, that was funny.
Remember that one? I can't remember the exact details, but it was something like they used a chatbot to quote him, you know, ridiculous prices for a new car or something like that.
No. It was Canada Air, which, by the way, is the worst airline. I love Canada, but man, it's Air Canada. Sorry. I've always had misery with them. But anyway, they gave him something like a $600 refund because they canceled his flight. So he went and asked for the refund and they were like, oh, sorry, that was a chatbot and we aren't honoring it.
And then the courts came through and he went to court and they had to honor what the chatbot told him. And it was just a straight up ChatGPT LLM. They didn't put any guardrails on it or anything. So I think one of the things that we're seeing is there still has to be humans in that loop. And that is not for obvious reasons. One of them is when the AI hallucinates, so it goes off on a tangent and starts just getting it wrong. And at this point in time, the AI sometimes systems, like the training or the models, you ask it a question and it just goes off and makes stuff up. Now, the AI companies, of course, who have a vested interest in saying exactly this, say the next version will fix that.
It won't. And here's the problem. Hallucinations are a built-in, they're a feature, not a bug. And in fact, what they talk about is model temperature. So you can turn it all the way down to zero, in which case your AI is completely factual, but it's fairly useless. Or you turn it all the way up to 10, in which case it's fantabulous, which might be absolutely ideal if you're a media company, an advertising agency, and you're trying to do a pitch meeting and you want to come up with all sorts of crazy ideas and winnow them out downstream. So essentially, you've got to think about not in terms of eliminating hallucinations, but mapping your model temperature to the use case.
Yeah. So the other one, I was just talking about the startup that got $29 million to copy and paste from email into a spreadsheet. It can format the data for you. We used to have an intern doing that, or some low-level, entry-level, first-year type person would do that task for a couple of years, and that would be training, right? But those people would also be applying a filter to that data and sanity checking it and going like, oh, that number's 10,000 when every other number is 100. Is that actually right? You know, things like that. And we can talk about the training aspect of that, or the learning aspect for people to skill up is another conversation. But part of the process for doing a lot of these tasks was so that somebody could cast their eyes across it. And now what we have is if somebody goes out and asks an AI a question and it comes back with an insane, a hallucinated response, or just a straight out wrong response, how do you detect that?
Well, if we assume that one of the main use cases for AI is going to be internal IT operations, the idea that AI can hallucinate or come up with all these incorrect assumptions or incorrect ideas, we can't just hand it the keys and be like, all right, you go ahead and make the decisions. I'm going to go get lunch. Like, a human still needs to be in a loop to sanity check what the AI is recommending and decide, okay, that's worthwhile. I remember when I was, this is going back a while, but when I was first rolling out VMware and we had DRS, and convincing certain administrators that enabling DRS where it would move around virtual machines to balance the cluster on its own was a good idea, they were just completely against it. And on the one hand, I understood. What if it makes the wrong decision and moves two VMs together that should not be together, or something along those lines? So there were all these edge cases where maybe DRS wasn't enabled. Now I'm thinking about, what about DRS, but with AI behind it and making even more important and potentially disastrous decisions in your internal IT? That's scary.
Well, not really. And the answer here is that the more narrow you focus an AI decision, the more likely it is to be correct. In the same way as a human can't, right?
So, well, yes, but no.
If you start to say the AI is going to juggle containers and VMs,
it's not about how narrowly to focus the decision. It is also about setting the temperature on your model. And that's why I want to be careful, because there's the user part, but there's also the machine part. And so you want to, when you're using a model, you want to make sure that you can actually adjust the temperature setting so it is where you need it to be. So if you're doing a creative brainstorming exercise, go all the way up to 11. You know, if you want it to be 100% accurate, scale it down so it's running very cold.
And so that's why today we see all of the AI tools go, I'll make a recommendation. All of the AI tools that I'm talking to on the people in, you know, AI ops for networking or AI ops around virtualization or containers, they come up and they react. And then they prompt a human and say, I'm seeing this. This is my recommended course of action. Do you want to do this? Right. There's a few things there. First of all, liability. The AI doesn't want to get, you know, with the way that the US law courts sit, you don't want to be sued for undertaking an action. The second one is the technology is still immature. There's a chance that it just could be wrong. Three, there's also the customer who probably in the main doesn't want to let this happen without having a human in the loop. So why force the issue? And fourth, the vendor probably doesn't have a high level of confidence that they're accurate. I mean, let's just set a baseline here. How long has it been since ChatGPT came on the market? How long have we been talking about AI?
It was December 2021. So December 2020, was it 21 or 22? December 22, I think.
22, I think.
Yeah.
So a year and a bit, 14 months. Just take a step back and go, like, we are 14 months into, so AI has been going on for decades in the background, but let's forget all that and say, in realism, AI only broke into what we're talking about, into the emergent phenomenon, broke out of the background noise to become an emergent phenomenon 14 months ago.
Exactly. That's about fair, yeah.
Right? So we are early. And it's probably worth touching on, why is there so much hype about AI? And here's my theory. The answer is, there's nothing else going on.
Yes.
You know, where's the mega thing going on in servers and CPUs? Where's the mega change in backup? Where's the mega transition in security? Where's the mega change in network? You know, what else is there that's cool in infrastructure land and technology right now?
We tried Web3.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think part of the reason there was such a big hype cycle around Web3 and blockchain and cryptocurrency was exactly that. Things had gotten somewhat boring. We were just making these incremental step improvements in terms of how things were working. People wanted a big blowout technology, and we latched onto the wrong one.
Yeah.
when I say we, I don't mean us on this podcast, because we were all far too smart.
Yeah, the feature of Web3 and blockchain was that it had to hype because there was nothing behind it. It was a hollow technology, right?
Right.
And we've seen plenty of those over the year. It's just the last time I saw one was in around about year 2000. Remember the Y2K bug? That is crypto all over again. It was absolutely hollow. There was no real problem. We all knew what we needed to do. Just sailing through it. So to me, crypto is like Y2K. It was a big deal, but at the end of the day, it was a nothing burger. But AI is kind of like, it's the only thing that's going to sell servers right now. Dell is stoked because it has a whole line of AI PCs where they've actually strapped in a couple of AI chips, and they're actually out knocking on customer doors saying, you can buy our power workstations again. So that whole market segment of power desktops, remember that, you know, the power user desktop that just kind of faded away?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I worked in an insurance company for a while, and our team that was over doing actuarial work, they would have these ridiculous workstations that were essentially a rack server, but in tower form.
Under their desk, usually.
Under their desk, 64 gig of RAM. And this is like back in 2005 or something, like just ridiculously overpowered to run Monte Carlo simulations in Excel. Mm-hmm. And now they can run those simulations in AI on the same tower, I suppose.
The point there is that whole market segment died off. You can go and buy an Apple M3 MacBook for $1,000. That is more than enough for everybody, except if you're going to do AI. So that whole power user desktop is suddenly back. And Dell's stoked. They're throwing big money into this, whole teams of people in there getting out there in front of, you know, that's reason that in 14 months, there's so much hype around it. And that does lead us to a question is, if you're the CIO or if you're in a technology team, should you care about enterprise AI?
And the answer is yes. Just
but
because something's-
no.
No, not really, but no, because it's like any other technology. If you're responsible for technology in your organization, you should bloody well care about it because it is technology and it will change a lot of different business processes. And more importantly, whether you do it or not, your lines of business are going to be doing it. And if you're not involved, they're going to be doing it badly. So two points I want to highlight. If you're the CIO at an enterprise or CTO or, you know, head of technology, the first thing you really want to look at is this whole concept of having digital ethics that are company-wide, because one of the ways to fashion guardrails around AI and the abuse of AI, Kyler, you were talking about the whole, well, what if they're tracking you everywhere kind of thing, is to have a digital ethics program, which includes not only a definition of what ethics is, but also how it applies to AI. And the catch is there's really no one within the organization that is qualified to implement the digital ethics, whatever you decide they are, to make sure that that's how it works, except the person that touches the technology or whose team touches the technology. And the second point that I want to make, though, is the biggest challenge that many enterprises are having right now, and I literally just last week was at a Wall Street Technology Association conference on the future of enterprise AI and financial services. And we did a panel discussion on this, and these were the leading folks at major banks saying the biggest challenge that we're facing is developing a meaningful use case for AI. And what I mean by that is not, oh, it's not useful and we're having trouble figuring out how to use it. It's more, where does it make sense and where does it not? And one of the examples that one of the panelists gave was, look, if you figure out that your use case will require an overnight run of your model to do something that you could have done almost as well with a human being in 30 minutes, that's not a good use case. It may be snazzy and flashy, but it's not a good use case. So you really have to look at the amount of time you have to spend. And we were talking earlier about the idea that a human should be checking every output of a model. Well, in a lot of scenarios, having the human check takes longer than generating the output in the first place. So, for example, initially, you had these legal briefs getting generated that had footnote references to cases that didn't exist in journals that didn't exist. Well, if you've got to go through and line by line validate that everything is accurate, you might as well just write that, because I can tell you it takes longer to edit crap well than it does to write something well in the first place.
And my point would be is if you're a CIO today, you can reasonably make a decision to do nothing. It is so early in the cycle.
No, you cannot. And here's why. Airplane reading syndrome. Because you're not in charge of the company. So you may decide to do nothing, but the head of sales is going to go, okay, that sounds good to me, CIO, and I'm going to go out and use ChatGPT to improve my sales, and there's nothing you can do about it. So therefore, it is not a reasonable to do nothing.
Let me be more nuanced then. If you're going to go and say, let's go and use ChatGPT to write sales letters, or if we're going to use Microsoft Copilot to write resumes faster or to analyze resumes faster, sure, go ahead and do that. There's not a lot of cost associated with that. There's no infrastructure. There's no strategy statements. And you can get some good learnings around it. But if you start saying, I'm going to start hiring a team of AI developers and start running my own inferencing algorithms to generate my own internal AI on my area of expertise, that is something that you certainly should start to analyze and investigate, but you shouldn't rush into it, because there's so much churn, there's so much innovation, so much disruption happening. Like today, it's NVIDIA with its GPUs is the leading silicon in the space. But as it turns out that NVIDIA's GPUs are the least capable AI chipsets. In the near term, we're looking at startups like Grok and Thales, who are building AI chipsets that run 50, 100, there's one I saw today, 650 times faster than an NVIDIA GPU using 60% less power. So if you are looking at the point where you say, now the flip side of this is if you decide, okay, I'm going to go and do it, I'm going to go and run it with NVIDIA, the trap here is that you are going to end up running the CUDA software. So what NVIDIA is doing is it's building a software layer over its hardware so that they lock you into their hardware. Right. And so they're giving away the software. It's like open source. It's free like a puppy. Right. And so if you start building these AI models or using, you know, NVIDIA's inferencing models or LLMs, you can get a bunch of free ones from NVIDIA or wherever. If you start bringing them on board today, you could be making a massive mistake that locks your AI strategy into a platform which is no longer market leading within 6 months.
So, Greg, here is my pushback on all of that. Everything you've said is 100% correct, except for the definition of the word you. The problem is nobody is going to sit around and wait for a CIO to get off his or her duff and make a decision about NVIDIA or not NVIDIA. The head of sales is going to say, if you won't do it, I will. And we've seen this before. It will happen. So what you as a CIO need to do is already put a framework around, and this is why I was trying to push back earlier, you have to have a framework around whether or not you actually want your sales team to be using ChatGPT to be writing, you know, sales letters. Probably not, because you don't want your information getting out into the wild. So you have to think through all that. But then you also have to have a strategy about the hardware and the software and under what circumstances you may go ahead and purchase it, which gets back to the whole question of working internally to develop those use cases and prove out those use cases before somebody signs on the dotted line and gets locked into NVIDIA for something that isn't even going to work.
Because what we're seeing is that it's most likely that NVIDIA is not the long-term winner. NVIDIA is today dominates the AI space completely, but AMD, Intel have processors coming out in this space that are going to be as competitive as NVIDIA's, but their software frameworks have not got first mover advantage. We're seeing any number of startups, there's literally dozens of startups building custom silicon in this space that performs better at certain narrow tasks. What I'm saying here is that don't pick a winner at this point. By all means, get involved and start projects, but don't say to yourself, we're picking a winner for our 10-year AI strategy.
Absolutely. You have to pick selection criteria and propagate the selection criteria out to the you that you weren't really considering, which is the head of sales and the rest of the company. So in other words, that you has to become a we. So everybody understands why you don't just buy the next shiny thing, because otherwise, if you just sit tight and say, I'm going to wait till this all sorts itself out. You're going to be behind the curve because your company will be moving ahead of you out and doing so in a very erratic, chaotic way because they're not technologists.
And I'm also not saying don't get involved with AI. By all means, Microsoft Copilot or Salesforce or, you know, whatever it is that you're going to use with it, you know, or what I call as accessory AI, you're going to use that and you might as well get involved and start using that because that'll accelerate tasks. And if you're managing an infrastructure, go and get some AI ops tools and start using that. Whoever it might be, Arcus, Juniper's data center, AI ops data center, so on and so forth, right?
Or Dynatrace for your data center, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You know, what they're doing is they're starting the process of, here's a piece of software, it's monitoring my infrastructure, it's using the observability information, running it into an AI system to come up with expert suggestions on what's going wrong. Oh, too many containers on this server. It's not going to move them for you or relocate them or shut them down. There's still going to be some other system in there, but that's not the same as setting up your own AI, like suddenly going in and taking all of your customer data and feeding it into training an AI model to be able to do something. If I was being asked to do that, I would slow down and start to do a much more, be much more cautious here because we are so early in this hype cycle that there's nothing but hype.
Well, I think it's important to start laying the groundwork for figuring out what is a good use case. And that's the point that I wanted to make because you as the technology department can't be sitting on your thumbs going, oh, I don't know what a good use case is. You've got to be out there with a clear understanding of the factors that you have to consider, such as things like the time it takes to do things and comparative time that it takes, the degree of accuracy you need at the end, things like, you know, model temperatures and things like that, and also data and intellectual property protection, privacy, bias, coming back to digital ethics again, all of those things you need to think about so that when, you know, you're at one of those boardroom meetings and the head of sales says, hey, we're using AI to do way better at sales, you can say, have you reviewed the framework? What is the expected ROI here? You know, and really stay ahead of it. So one of the things we found actually is most organizations have teams both within IT and outside IT, and the teams outside IT are 100% to significantly more larger than the teams inside IT. So if you don't have people in IT that have an understanding of all these factors, you're behind the curve.
I'm hearing like a HR for AI.
Oh, yeah. Well,
like literally like what HR is, it's protecting the company from its employees, right? So what you need is a team of people making sure the AI doesn't damage the company.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure I see that because basically what you've got right now is inside lines of business, roughly 79% of organizations have teams inside lines of business that are already doing AI inside lines of business.
Yeah, but it's not big AI, right? And I want to draw a line here between little AI and big AI.
There,
right?
No, it is.
If you're
big
using
AI.
Microsoft Copilot to generate a quote faster or better or to write a cover letter, that's little AI.
No, that's what I'm trying to tell you is within lines of business, particularly in sophisticated organizations, they're forging ahead because they've been using data to do their business. They're layering AI on top of it. I know you're saying that it's, you know, you can just sort of slow everything down, but if you're an IT person, you cannot. Possibly if you're the CEO of the company, but even then, I would be skeptical.
I like being the department of no. No, you can't.
You don't have the power. And that's the main thing is you've got bunches and bunches of people who don't report to you, don't even think you add value, who are off doing stuff. So you need to be ahead of them in a positive way, saying things like, I know you like NVIDIA, but let's talk about what our selection criteria in general should be. And perhaps this whole issue of avoiding lock-in is something you may want to consider.
I mean, this market is so strange, right? Because those companies who are making silicon chips, they've actually got a path to market, right? They don't have to go and build those chips and then try and sell them to AWS or Google or to enterprises or to telcos, right? What they can actually do is build it, start generating models, run the inferencing, build up a model, sell it as an API, and then they can get a revenue stream. And then they can keep growing the company, right? One of the interesting things about AI, about up until now, building a silicon chip has always been a specialist thing. You think about silicon inside of switches or storage arrays, like fiber channel storage arrays or whatever, that you had to build, if you wanted to make that chip, well, that had to be a company building a thing that you could then ship to an enterprise to buy. Somebody had to go and buy the box that had the silicon in it. Whereas now with AI, you can build the chip, sell it as a SaaS, like, you know, ChatGPT online, $20 a month, whatever. And there's plenty of those going on, or sell it as an API. And then all of a sudden you've got scale, you start iterating the chipset a little bit further. Then you start to say, okay, I've got this chip. I'm now building it at a sufficient scale that I can sell it. And then boom, they've got a path to market. It's one of the most interesting things to me is this fascinating that AI hardware is actually viable from small companies. It's not.
It's wild that we care about hardware again.
I know. Isn't that great?
And it's wild that we actually see it in desktops and in laptops, as well as in the data center, right? So on-prem AI, in my opinion, is a thing. And I think it will make very solid investment advice to do it on-prem because you've got these models and, you know, people go on and on and saying like, oh, but it takes so long to generate the models. Well, if you own the hardware, so what? A day?
Well, so what is if you can get the answer better by having a human, you know?
If you can have a fixed cost and know that your cost to build this AI project is capped, but it takes twice as long, well, maybe that's a trade-off you want, right? If you're a startup and you're burning money, well, then, you know, you don't do that. You go into the cloud and you don't care how much you spend because you've got to get to a product before you run out of cash, before your investors realize you're actually running a scam, right? That's just lighting up money and burning it on fire, right? So there's two different use cases here around AI, right?
Well, there's many, many use cases, but yes.
Yeah, but I think in this particular case, I think that there is a place for enterprise AI. There is a place for generating your own models, inferencing them on-prem in your data center where your data is, not exporting it to the cloud and paying $1 million to get it out into the cloud, running it on expensive off-prem hardware that costs 350% more than doing it on-prem. And when you're finished with it, you've still got the hardware, right? So you can do it again, right? Whereas most of the people are going to the cloud, they pay, and then it's gone. The money's gone.
Greg, I will absolutely agree that it is quite likely that AI will be a significant driver to bringing a lot of computing back on-prem for the reasons that you just say. There are cost benefits and there are also protection benefits, data protection benefits, and people are realizing this. And just for the record, Greg has been arguing for a long time that the wholesale rush to the cloud was a mistake and that people really need to be thinking long and hard about what workloads to outsource to the cloud and what workloads to keep in-house.
It's not a complete mistake, but it's generally a mistake. Most workloads should be on-prem for cost control. And what people are realizing, of course, is when they go off-prem, they just made it worse. The networking got worse, the storage got worse, the backup got worse, the whole where's... And now they have entire teams of people just trying to work out what they're paying for.
Not necessarily.
That's not better.
That is the worst case of going to cloud. Hopefully you had a cloud workload process in place and you made these decisions intelligently going in. But, you know, people aren't perfect.
If I add AI to that, it just got worse, right? So I'd be cautious about doing it in the cloud.
I'm hearing that we need a Greg and Jonah LLM to tell me about my cloud costs. And I think that's our next product. So that should be what we build next.
Well, we have enough podcast hours that I think we can just load the transcripts into an LLM.
Go.
And we're good to go, right?
Well, it'll come out with a lot of pretty language, but I'm not sure it'll have much value.
Well, speaking of podcasts, Greg, Jonah, you have your own podcast. And if people have been enjoying this sort of debate that Tyler and I have been watching, where can they find that podcast? What is it all about, Jonna?
It's called Heavy Strategies and it's at packetpushers.net. Just go there, enter Heavy Strategies, and you'll see not only the semi-accurate transcripts, but all of the 64 odd episodes that we've got, pros and cons about pretty much every issue under the sun having to do with technology strategy for enterprise organizations.
Awesome. And if people want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Please come visit nerdist.com. There's a contact us form, and I would dearly love to hear from you. Suggest ideas. Tell us what you want to talk about. And you can also go to the Heavy Strategies FU, which is the follow-up, and give us your ideas anonymously there.
What about you, Greg?
I'm still hanging out on Twitter. Probably not for too much longer. The burden of being
there. You say that every time.
You're still there.
I'm still there. It works for me. It's probably because I've been on Twitter for so long. It's kind of instinctive at this point, but I'm also doing much more over at LinkedIn. So if you just go over to LinkedIn and search for me as Greg Farrow, you can follow me along there. I post out my splats, as I call them, which is little mental nuggets of something that you can enjoy if you follow along on LinkedIn. And then, of course, on the various podcasts, the Network Break and the Heavy Strategy podcast are the two that I'm participating in these days.
All right. Excellent. You can find me on LinkedIn as well. And well, I don't really do the Twitter thing. I finally got off of it. You know what I did? I moved the app on my phone to a different spot and my thumb doesn't go there anymore. Kyler can be found on LinkedIn as well and on her website, which we'll include links to in the show notes. Thank you all of you for joining for today's Day 2 Cloud. And hey, listener, virtual high fives to you for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, we would love to hear them. Hit us up on the follow-up link. That's packetpushers/FU. That is for follow-up. Your mind out of the gutter. You can also send us a message on LinkedIn if that's your preference as well. And did you know that you don't have to scream into the technology void alone? The Packet Pushers Podcast Network has a free Slack group that's open to everyone. You can visit packetpushers.net/slack and join. It's a marketing-free zone for engineers to chat, compare notes, tell war stories, and solve problems together. Visit packetpushers.net/slack. Until next time, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.